Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my pleasure to have prolific songwriter and producer, Mr. John Madara. Hi, John.
How you doing, Mike, tonight? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. And, John, let me tell you, you were the sound of Philadelphia. You were TSOP, man, let me tell you.
Well, I guess because if you're old enough, you were there before some of the other people. But, it was fun making those early records. I had a lot of fun making those early records.
And you were born in Philly, and, you know, so much talent came out of Philly. It's just amazing, you know, right down the line, how many talented people that were part of our genre that grew up in Philly.
Amazing. It really is. I mean, beside the talent that we worked with, and then Gamble Huff had so much great talent. He had a lot in Cameo Parkway. And of course, Chancellor Records with Frankie Avalon, Fabian.
Absolutely.
Alan.
Absolutely. I mean, the list is so long that, it's to be continued and continued. So how was it growing up in Philly?
I tell you, Mike, it was the best. You know, being a teenager and kind of growing up with the Patti Pages and the Frankie Lanes and
right.
the Whispers. And then I remember this guy one day, Johnny Ray.
Oh, yeah.
And I said to myself, boy, that's different. And then all of a sudden, it kind of drifted where I started listening to R&B music, and the Clovers, the Moonglows, Billy Ward and the Dominoes.
Right.
They became the music that I kind of switched gears, because that other music was kind of so old now. And this new music that had this incredible beat, then there was Little Richard and Fats Domino. And by then, you know, you're so hooked into the music.
Right.
To me, it was such a joy to grow up in Philadelphia around that many talented people and be able to be a part of the music business.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, Lloyd Price tells the story that, you know, when he went into the Army for a little while, he came back and Little Richard was singing with his band and had bumped him out. So he said, you know what? I'm starting a record company. See ya.
He's a really nice man.
What a nice man he is. Oh, yeah, for sure. So you had an office in the Schubert Building.
Yes, that kind of was the music building then, Mike.
Right.
Kenny Gamble and Jerry Ross.
Right.
Had an office on the sixth floor.
Right.
And our office was on the second floor with Leon Huff and David, myself.
Right.
It was kind of a really music mecca. And in fact, our offices had so many people in them writing songs or auditioning, and it was a real special time that I guess has never been duplicated. We had all these young artists that just wanted to be singers, and it was such the beginning of it all, because the business was really older artists.
Right.
Where the early rock and roll started. I mean, everyone that was out there who had hit records were older people.
Well, I ran up and down the Brill Building a lot, you know, with stuff that I had, and they always used to say to me the same thing. We love it, we love it, we love it, but, you know, it's really not for us. I mean, Joe Kolsky at Roulette and this one and that one, I still have the letters. Great stuff, really not for us right now, you know.
Hey, but we brought At the Hop, well, actually it was called Do the Bop.
Right.
It was supposed to be my second record on Prep Records. We brought that record up to Prep. There was a guy by the name of Manny Kellum. I'll never
right.
forget it. And Manny Kellum listens to the record, and he goes, what is that? I said, that's rock and roll, man.
From 1957, here is the way that At the Hop originally sounded. Do the Bop, Danny and the Juniors, on Radio Active Gold.
Bop. Let's all do the bop. Let's all do the bop. Let's all do the bop.
Right.
And so it was the only time I've ever recorded where I didn't have anything to do with making the record.
Wow.
So I had to go in the studio with Sid Feller, who was producing Paul Anka.
Right.
And I recorded these additional sides for prep.
Uh-huh.
But through the bop, went back to Philadelphia and played it for Dick Clark. And Dick said, well, the bop's not really happening. He said, around the country. He says, why don't you change it to something about record hops?
Right. Here's Dick Clark again.
Yep, so Do the Bop became At the Hop.
Well, you can rock it, chop it, roll it, do the slop and even stroll it at the hop. When a record starts spinning, it's your lips and when you chicken at the hop. Do the dance sensations that are sweeping the nation at the hop. Let's go to 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 the hop. Come on. Let's go to the hop. Well, you can swing it, you can do it, you can really start to move it at the hop. Where the jockey is the smoothest and the music is the coolest at the hop. All the cats and the chicks gonna get their kicks at the hop.
Let's go!
Let's go to the hop. 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 Come on. Let's go to the hop. Let's go! And even stroll it at the hop. When a record starts spinning, eat your lips and when you chicken at the hop. Do the dance sensations that are sweeping the nation at the hop. You can swing it, but you can really stop and move it at the hop. Where the jockey is the smoothest and the music is the coolest at the hop. All the cats and the chicks gonna get their kicks at the hop. Let's go!
Right. Well, you know, the Dick and his wife, you know, they really plugged into everything. You know, as the way I understand, Dick Clark's wife took Fats Domino and made Chubby Checker out of it.
Well, the name, I always heard that the name was the Cal Mann, who was one of the writers and producers at Cameo Parkway.
Right.
He just took Fats Domino and just changed it around.
Right.
Cameo did with their records.
Right.
Cameo records were really spin-offs of other records.
Hey, listen,
a lot of their records were.
I mean, look, you know, Hank Ballard did it way back before then.
Of course. Hank Ballard had the Twist. And,
right.
And it was Chubby that went in and made it, and they got their records played on Bandstand. And,
right.
And the Chubby Checker version, which doesn't even come close to the Hank Ballard version.
Absolutely not. You are absolutely right.
Became the hit. And that was the same way with records like Please Mr. Postman.
Right.
Came Mashed Potato Time.
Right.
The Fish Mama Said.
Right.
I mean, go down a list of all the records and you'll find an oldie that was the source for that creation.
Right. And pretty much, you know, I think as a writer myself and being very creative myself, and we had this talk the other day, you know, when we create, we're just the sum total of what we've heard and experienced and kind of, you know, maybe there are no new creations. Maybe we just express them in a different way each time.
Well, I think that definitely is right. But I think also in Cameo's case, their goal was to take that record and copy it, really copy the whole idea
right.
with the same beat and make it into a dance.
I got you.
All of a sudden, if the kids were doing the Mashed Potatoes to Please Mr. Postman,
right.
well, they'd go and wrote Mashed Potatoes.
Right.
And the Mama Said became Do the Fish, Do the Fish. And
right.
So that was their goal. They have all the dances.
Well, as long as we're into that, talking about that particular subject now, I'm going to throw one at you. I will tell you that when I was younger, the first time I heard the Bristol Stomp, I went nuts, and so did everybody who heard that record. That was such a great record, and of course, Len Barry's voice was the one that made that record, but Dick Clark was crazy about it, and that was just a Philly phenomenon tune.
But that was a Stone copy.
Yeah.
Sunday to Monday to Tuesday
right.
to Wednesday, Fridays, and whoa.
Right.
That was a Stone copy.
I hear you.
Exactly what that was the formula for Cameo Records.
Right.
They would catch one of those records that the kids were doing the stomp to.
Right.
Which was that record.
Right.
I don't even remember the name of that record.
Right.
It was the Students.
Correct.
Yeah, and they took that record and they wrote the Bristol Stomp.
Unbelievable. See, now I actually never knew that, but, you know, now that you mention it, it's a good way to go if you're trying to produce records, and you're absolutely right.
The kids in Bristol are sharp as pistol when they do the Bristol Stop. Really something when the joint is jumping when they do. Whoa!
own bandstand.
Right.
So, you know, if you bring in a record that says Mashed Potato Time,
right,
bring in a record, you know, that says the Bristol Stomp,
right,
you're actually telling the kids this is the dance you're doing already.
Right. Because I was doing the slop and the bop in those days, too.
Oh, yeah. We had a record called Slop Time.
Yeah.
But it was original. It wasn't a copy from anything.
Right. I hear you. Now, Dave White was your partner, right, for a while?
David White, who lives in Las Vegas.
Right.
And we're still very close, and we communicate a couple times a week.
Which is great.
Oh, yeah. And we wrote the story for hopefully the upcoming film, At the Hop.
Right.
And we've written 3 brand-new songs for the film. So it's been great working with somebody that I've known since Dave was about 16 and a half or so, and I was about 18 and a half.
Right.
We've known each other so long, and it's great. It's great. We have a real rapport in writing songs together.
Tell me about the record Do the Bop and how it actually became At the Hop.
Dave White and I were on a subway elevated train going out to pick up, I was getting a used car, and we were driving out, on the elevator, going out to get the car, and I said to Dave, David, the kids are doing the Bop on TV like crazy. I said, why don't we write a song called Do the Bop?
Right.
Kind of what Cameo was doing. This was still, you know, early. I mean, Cameo really hadn't had very many records. But I think, the 57, the only thing they really had at that point was Charlie Gracie's Butterfly. So they really hadn't got into the dance copying thing yet. But I came back to Dave and I said, listen, I said, the kids are doing the Bop. Why don't we write a song called Do the Bop?
Right.
And we'll do it with your group. So, and I said, well, maybe I'll sing lead because I need to do a follow-up record to a record I had out called Be My Girl.
Okay.
We went home, wrote the song, and went in the studio, and I wanted to get like a Jerry Lee Lewis feel.
Right.
We did, and recorded it, put it up to Prep Records, who I was under contract to,
right,
and they said, uh-uh.
Yeah.
That's when we brought it back, and they played it for Dick Clark.
Right.
And suggested the title change.
Right.
Just took Danny, who was the lead singer for Dave's group.
Right.
He really emulated my performance that I did on Do the Bop. And the rest is history.
Right. So let me ask you this. I'm going to throw you a curve. When did the Geeter come into all of this? the Geeter with the heater. When did he appear on the scene for Danny and the Juniors? Do you know?
Jerry, yeah, sure. Jerry worked for a guy by the name of Nat Siegel.
Yeah, Jerry Blabbitt, in case you don't know who we're talking about. The Geeter with the heater.
Boss with the hot sauce.
Right.
Anyway, Jerry was working for this guy, Nat Siegel,
right,
who was managing and booking Danny and the Juniors.
Gotcha.
And Jerry came out of Bandstand, where he was the dance organizer on Bandstand.
Uh-huh.
Organized all the dance groups for Bandstand. And then he went to work for Nat. And then he was on the road with Danny and the Juniors as their road manager.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry always says he taught them how to dress. They dressed terribly.
Well, you know, I worked with them a bunch of times, you know, way, way, way back. And all I remember was they all came up to my shoulder. they weren't tall guys on the Bandstand.
No, they were all very short.
Right.
And Jerry taught them a lot, and because he taught them how to dress, bought them all their clothes.
Wow.
Jerry was a big part that beginning there, and
uh-huh.
then of course Jerry went into radio.
Right.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I haven't seen him in a long time.
Well, you know, when I was in Philly about 5 or 6 years ago. I hung out with a very good friend of his. We were going to go see him actually that night, and we did not. And I know that every once in a while he gets down to Southern Florida, and I know he was at the Hard Rock about 2 years ago, just doing a sock hop kind of a thing, you know. And of course, you know, sticking his face out there to a lot of Southern Florida people that are from Philadelphia that just love to see him, you know.
I must tell you something. He looks unbelievable.
Great.
I must say, he looks like he has the body of, say, a 30-year-old guy.
Wow.
I mean, he's got the six-pack. He's got the whole nine yards.
Terrific.
Oh, yeah, he's so ripped and looks so good. I like that because it kind of, you know, it's what I do for myself.
He probably picked up some HGH when he passed through Boca.
Maybe, my friend, maybe.
Yeah, who knows?
Jerry has a long history, history of Philadelphia, really a long history.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that I know what people love him. I know the people down here that are from Philly, and there are quite a few people in Southern Florida from Philly, you know, they love the guy.
Well, he still has that excitement that he always had. And I'll tell you, I went to a record hop the last time I was in Philly.
Right.
It was Jerry's record hop, and I went there. And as I'm walking from the back of the where the hop is, he evidently caught me. And he starts, while the record's playing, he starts singing At the Hop, and he starts singing a few of our songs as the record he was playing. And then he says, "Hey, it's my band, Johnny Madera." and the people were there were just like, it was like being at the record hop in 1957, 1959, but these people were in their 60s.
Right, right.
But Jerry was still as exciting as he always was, and it was great.
Well, the baby boomers love to go back. I mean, they just, you know, they sit at these shows and they just sing every line. And I'll tell you something, with the aficionados, if the first tenor sings something different, they'll come backstage afterwards and say, you know, the first tenor part didn't really go that way. It went like this. They know.
Exactly, because there's a lot of fans out there of the early doo-wop things. There's a lot of fans.
And they want to hear it the way they know it.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
It's unbelievable. So, you know, you did let the cat out of the bag about the movie. So, you know, while we're on the subject of the movie, let's talk about the movie.
Yeah, well, you know, our goal was to make a film that really created that era, that early first decade of rock and roll, when rock and roll was just springing out of Philadelphia, and there was all these groups were creeping out from Detroit, and really mostly from Baltimore.
Right.
And then up through Philly. And Philly, that story's never been told. And people have tried to make that story, but it's always about the business. It's always about the points, and it's always about payola, or it's always about something that has to do with someone's hard life. But it's not about the reality of what the kids felt and what the adults felt.
Right.
And what the change in music did and then has affected our society till now.
Right.
That was a period that really was the age of innocence. No one's ever really created that. There's been musical Grease was not really it. Happy Days was not it.
Right.
And if you go back to some of the other serious films like American Hot Wax, that was all about the business.
Right. Or Hairspray or, you know.
It was a musical.
Yeah. There were all kind of follies and fantasies built around it, you know.
I'm talking about Martin Scorsese, Goodfellas, that reality.
Right. I hear you. In the nooks and crannies.
Yes. And we've got a great screenplay, and I've got a great director, great DP.
Right.
And got a few parts that are already cast, Joe Pesci being one.
Fabulous.
So we're moving forward, and our biggest goal is to keep it independent. I don't want to go through the studio system. I want to keep it as independent so that when we make our movie, I can pick who I want the distributor to be.
Gotcha.
Not to have to go through the studio where they pick sometimes the director. They'll pick the creative people to be around you. And I don't want that. I want to make my own movie.
Right.
Put my own records, and I want to make my own movie.
And then all of a sudden it becomes the way they see it or through their eyes, and it becomes something that it's not. And, you know, because I guess at this point it's not even about the money. It's about telling the story the right way.
Oh, exactly. But to create that on screen so that 20 years from now, when people say, what was the movie would you say that really depicted that first decade of rock and roll?
Right.
At the Hop, that's the one.
Right.
That's the one. When you want to learn about what happened in that transition of music.
Right.
And how kids were affected, how the adults were affected, and how it affected kids forever.
Right.
And that story's never been told. And I can't think of one film, and I've watched them all, those music-driven films, not one. The musicals were great.
Right.
Musicals were great, and it was a great kind of tongue-in-cheek look at the period. But that real street feel that we had living in South Philadelphia, or living in the heart of Baltimore, and that feeling that was different. It was more... it was more of the street. It was more hanging out in the corners and guys getting together. Hey, you heard that new Clovers record? Man, that guy does that.
Hey.
Yeah, let's do something like that.
The good groups, like, you know, I had a group when I was in high school, and, you know, those groups that I used to hang around with, they were so good that they didn't have a repertoire. If somebody came over and said, hey, you guys, do this tune, we just chimed off and we sang it. There was no bullshit. In other words, we didn't go, we just sang it. That was it.
The music was so much a part of a teenager's life.
Right.
And again, that story has never been told because it wasn't like rock and roll was around for a long time and somebody, and, you know, a record came out, oh, that is a great record.
Right.
It went nuts over it. But no, I'm talking about how it affected someone who was really growing up with those Joe Staffords, the Patti Pages, and
right.
Lanes, and how first time when he hears that music and how it affects his soul.
Right.
His life is already destined to go someplace else.
It's amazing how many people have said to me, Johnny Ray was the guy. I mean, I did a lot of work with Johnny Maestro in the Brooklyn Bridge years ago when I had my Harmony Street group, and John and I did an interview together, and the DJ who was interviewing said, you know, the first thing, so, you know, who were you inspired by? And the first thing Johnny Maestro said was, Johnny Ray.
Oh, man.
I heard Johnny Ray, and that was it.
He shook me up. I mean, first time I saw him, I mean, just shook me up. And the vocal and the way what he did with his voice at the end of Cry, I just went, wow, this guy is something brand new.
Well,
the act was Les Paul, Mary Ford.
He put
those two acts were kind of, to me, the segue between the music that was the early 50s into the rock and roll.
Well, no, nobody's ever equaled Les Paul. And you know, I mean, look, I'm a guitar player, too. I'm playing since I'm 8 years old, and I listen to a lot of Les Paul and a lot of Chet Atkins. That's what I cut my teeth on.
Great stuff.
Yep.
Great stuff. And I love Les Paul. I actually saw his studio in Jersey.
Wow.
Where he recorded all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Genius.
Which was a real thrill. It was for sale. And I remember we went and recording at Bell Sound. They had this big sign up for Les Paul Studio for sale.
Wow.
And so, man, I'd love to go out just to see it.
No, I hear you.
And he had a custom-made multi-track machine.
Right.
That was made for him. And I always thought that Les Paul was actually the first hard-body guitar.
But yeah.
It was not. He was not the first hard-body
guitar. Uh-huh.
It was developed, actually. Fender actually developed a hard-body guitar.
Leo Fender, yeah.
And, but then there was someone else before that also did a hard body way back in the 40s.
Wow.
Yeah, so yeah, I saw a thing on the blues, and it's really interesting to see how some of the early blues guitar players got their sounds.
It's amazing because when I was a kid, my father brought a guy over the house. Two guys, as a matter of fact. One's name was Billy Bauer, and I just looked at him as an old man. I was like a young kid. And all of a sudden, I went to the library one day. I looked in the Encyclopedia of Jazz, and he was all over it. And the other one was George Thorne, who wrote I Hear a Rhapsody. And I didn't know who he was because I was like 13 years old. And after I realized who the guy was, I says, oh, my God, you know, I'm being taught by guys who, you know. And Billy Bauer had a book where he only took on professional guitar players. And, you know, the first page of his book was like volume three of everybody else's guitar method. So, you know, it was like I was in good company, but boy, they put me through it, you know.
There's a great special, if you haven't seen it, it's running on Smithsonian,
uh-huh.
About guitars.
Wow.
All about how the guitar was first electrified.
Right.
They did it, who did it first. And then then it goes into the hard bodies. It's a really, really, really
good. Oh, yeah, it's great stuff because, you know, it's part of, you know, these kids now that get up and they twang. And, you know, what's funny is that every generation gets better and better. You know, we talked about the kids, you know, coming to my house, you know, and they make the Pro Tools sing, and I'm just, like, sitting there. I mean, I'm lazy. I don't even punch in when I have to add something else. I just pull up another track because it's right there, you know. So it's crazy. But, you know, the kids nowadays, they're not aware of the history. I sat Vanilla Ice down one day and I says, hey, you know what, buddy, if it wasn't for all of my old friends doing what they did, there would be no you.
That's the absolute truth. That's the absolute truth.
Yeah, you know.
That goes all the way back to even the classical composers. I mean, they're, you know, if the earliest guy who did something and then he did something unusual with the strings or the
right.
Woodwinds or something, and the next guy who was composing and there it's in his mind and he said, I'll use woodwinds. Oh yeah, that woodwinds are cool. And then he said, maybe I'll add these other things, these cellos
right.
Over here.
Oh yeah.
This was, you know, growth, and we owe it all to, it's, you know, everybody's just a kind of a progression of music. That's all it is.
I always say that it was evolution, and you know, it's like, you know, the people that you know, the grandfathers and that decade and generation before that said, oh, you know, you're playing that hip hop stuff, you know, and those crazy lyrics, man, and that junk jive and all of that. Well, you know, it evolved to that. Just the way we look at music now, music reflects the times, and we say to ourselves, whether we like it or not, this is what it has evolved to.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I always say to myself, if what I'm hearing back reflects the times, then we need to change something, you know.
The thing is, if you go back and listen to Little Milton and,
right.
or B.B. King, or
right.
some of the early records of Muddy Waters,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they had those guitar little blues things going, man, and your foot couldn't stop going because it was just that rhythm they played. And that to me was the inspiration for...
I'm going to throw one at you now, too, because, you know, I know that you knew Joe Cook and Little Joe and the Thrillers, and I worked with him in Boston about 3 or 4 years ago. We did a Harvey Robbins show when I was with George Galfo's Mystics. And I want to tell you that he's almost 80. He got up on that stage and he sang Peanuts in that false, and he sang it like he was like 25 years old.
God bless him.
Peanut.
daughters, the Sherrys.
Right.
And we had a couple of records with them. Little Joe and the Thrillers.
Yeah, the guy still sings, man. He's up in Boston now, from what I understand.
The week there was a guy died, General Johnson.
Right.
With the chairman of the board.
Right.
He came by our office in the 60s, mid-60s, looking for a record deal. And we were working with Len Barry at the time.
Right.
And he went on to get a deal at the Swan. And he made a record there before, this is way before Invictus and the chairman of the board.
Right.
But he made a record there called In Paradise.
Right.
Oh, if you've never heard that record, oh, Mike, it's such a great record.
Mm-hmm.
And he is such a great lead singer.
Right.
The record they made it at Motown Invictus. Their records were sensational.
Oh, yeah.
Sensational records.
Oh, yeah.
There was a guy in there by the name of Eddie Custis.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the singers that sang background. But Eddie Custis, Dave and I recorded him under the group The Hearts.
Right.
And Eddie Custis. Dave always said the best lead singer that we ever worked with was Eddie Custis.
Wow.
And I just listened to some of the demos we did with him, actually, with Ellie Greenwich. And I'll tell you, Eddie Custis was a great singer.
Well, you know, but the thing is, there were an awful lot of guys, and you know as well as I do, there were guys who made it. I mean, I was a kid on Long Island, and we used to go to a place called My House, and one of the groups, because I had a group too, we used to play the same place, and Billy Joel had the Hassles in those days, and it was Billy Joel and a bunch of other guys, Liberty DeVito, Richie Cannata on bass, Richie Cannata on sax, excuse me, and... you know, Billy Joel was William Joel, keyboard player. It wasn't until he went out to California and did the Piano Man album that all of a sudden he skyrocketed, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And there were groups that was just as good that didn't make it. And those guys, some of them are still struggling musicians, and some of them are now accountants and music lawyers.
You know, I always said the reason for that was that the suits ran the business.
Right.
The suits didn't have ears.
Right.
They only knew what... was out there.
Right.
They didn't hear tomorrow. They didn't know what was going to happen tomorrow at all.
Right.
So a lot of the artists that went and auditioned for record companies went home to Kenosha, Wisconsin, or went home to wherever they were from.
Right.
And flipping hamburgers or doing something that, you know, that their talent just went to waste because of having people at the record companies who just did not know.
Right.
That's the one statement I know that I could say for a fact, my years in the record business, I would say that 90% of the people I dealt with didn't know.
Right.
I mean, you had the rare ones, the Reef Mardans, and the people like that, that were the guys who really had a great ear and really knew what tomorrow was. Even though they were part of the older set, they knew. Jerry Wexler and the Atlantic people, they really knew their stuff.
Right.
Of course, later, Clive Davis, who really, I think, was really an excellent record executive. He really had a good taste for what was tomorrow. But during that period of the early rock and roll days, those guys were really from the Sinatra, Nat King Cole. And,
right.
And rock and roll to them was disgusting.
No, I hear you. Hey, listen, Mitch Miller campaigned against it as hard as he could.
Oh, I remember. I remember, in Columbia wouldn't sign Rock and Roll Act.
Right.
I mean, that was like almost taboo.
Yeah, later on they did. Do you know Johnny Luongo?
No, I don't know. I know his name, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think he was with CBS. You know, he's a guy that I just got kind of connected with and whatever. So let's talk about Len Barry. You were right there with 1-2-3 for Len Barry.
It's easy. smart about love. Basically, it's as easy as pie. The hard part is living without love. Without your love, baby, I would die. From a baby, hey, 21 or two, I know you love me and oh, oh, how I love you. Don't try to fight it, cause it's easy, like taking
Jerry Gross from the Dovells, all those guys, we were all friends. And we used to hang out, and I had a record shop in 1961.
There's two groups that, for white guys, could just dance their behinds off. One was the Del Satins, the other one was the Dovells. You saw the Dovells live on stage, man. Those guys flew around the stage.
They were great. I mean, they were great. And like I said, we were all friends. We used to hang out at my record shop and practice and sing songs together. And so when Lenny had his hits over at Cameo,
right,
he wanted Lenny, then, you know, we decided, I don't think Lenny and Jerry got along real well.
Right.
Lenny wanted to go out and be a solo
right
artist, and of course we were all friends. And
well, you know, I met Len, you know, a bunch of times. Sometimes he had a little edge to him.
You know, yeah, no, Lenny definitely had a real edge.
Yeah.
But the thing was, is that when it came to music, there was a thing that would happen between the three of us, between
right
myself and David White and Lenny.
Right.
And there was a real magic there. Remember when we wrote 1, 2, 3?
Wow.
I'd had the melody and the title 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
And I walked in, and we were going to have a writing session that day because we were going to be recording Lenny in a
right
couple of weeks. So I walked in and I said, Len, that this great melody, great title, 1, 2, and 3. Lenny's instantly, no, 1, 2, 3.
Right.
We wrote that song, that whole afternoon we spent in the room writing, and we finished the song. And that, and you'll like this story, Mike.
Well, it's elementary and it's easy. I mean, you know, what could be better than that?
Well, what happened was, there was a bridge in that.
Right.
Maybe there's nothing hard about love.
Yes.
That part. Well, that didn't exist in the song at all.
Basically, it's as easy as pie. I know the whole tune.
But that didn't exist in the song. That was never there.
Wow.
We're on our way to the studio, and what we used to have, our little formula was, we always like to put a little breaks, drum breaks, before we went into a sax solo.
Okay.
So we had this drum break written into the arrangement, and we're walking over to the studio, and Lenny said, you know, I don't feel right about that bridge. He says, maybe we should put some words in there. And Lenny,
uh-huh,
I'm telling you, could write a lyric like that.
Right.
I mean, he came up with words so fast, I couldn't believe it. So by the time we finished the walk to the studio, which was about 5 minutes, then he had that, baby, there's nothing hard about love.
I remember.
I said, Len.
Basically.
And that was a live session. Lenny says, he says, I sang better, he said, but I never sang right on as much as I did that night.
I hear you.
And he did. It was perfect. And the group was the Times and this group that we used, the Sweet Three, out of Philly. And that was two groups that did because we used the girl answers, boy answers, then boy and girl
uh-huh
answers together, well, throughout the record.
Right.
That was a great record to make. I had so much
fun. It was a great record to listen to.
Yeah. There was a thing that we did on that, Mike. It was a Bell Sound, which Bell Sound had a very big studio, because the control room was like on a second level, and the main part of it, you had to walk down steps into the actual studio. And it was a real high ceiling.
So right.
Before the session, I said to the engineer, I said, I want you to put a microphone way up at the corner at the top of the studio.
Okay.
And so he said, what do you want to do that for? I said, just do it. I said, I want to hear what it sounds like.
Uh-huh.
So we put that had on a separate channel.
So it fattened the vocals, probably.
No, what it did was it picked up all the overtones from the room.
Uh-huh.
From I had three guitars and two bass players.
Right.
And two drummers. And I think the horns were just strictly two saxes and a trumpet.
Yeah.
I think that was it.
A good old room mic. A room mic.
So, I did was when I mixed, I actually brought up the room sound.
Yeah, and you bled it right in. I know what you mean.
The mix, and I'll tell you something. That's how we got that huge drum sound that had on that record.
Uh-huh.
You know, Mike, I swear to God, when I get talking about music, it's...
Isn't that fun, though? Creating.
It's who I am. If I can be in the worst headspace.
Yeah.
I start talking about music, it just makes me light up.
I take my hat off to all the guys. I mean, you know, I was lucky enough to hang at Media Sound and Soundworks, Alan Raymer's place, and Power Station, and I even got invited to Secret Sound, which is Richie Calandra's from Spira Gyra, and I watched and I listened, and I was a fly on the wall, and sometimes got a chance to do some vocals and do some guitar work and everything else, you know, with all of these greats. And what's funny about it is that I thought to myself, my God, you know, these people are taking noise and they're making it sound better, you know, and then to the point where, I mean, hey, you know, my cousin is Gary Katz. I got to sit in on a few of the Steely Dan overdubs for the Asia album. And I'm telling you, you talk about an intense session.
Oh yeah!
Couldn't inhale or exhale. It was like ridiculous, you know. But hey, it's great.
I did a session with Bo Diddley in Seattle.
Right.
The guy who managed him wanted a kind of contemporary rock and roll, kind of Vanilla Fudge. That kind of rock and roll.
I knew them when they were the Pigeons, and I knew them when they went into Ultrasonic Studios in Hempstead, Long Island, because I lived there. And Bill Stahl was the engineer, and they did You Keep Me Hanging On, and they were the Pigeons before they were the Fudge. Go ahead.
Well, what happened was the manager went. So the manager was friends with Carmine Appice.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets Carmine and Timmy Bogart.
Mm-hmm.
And... then we brought, there was a guitar player who had been part of the Wrecking Crew, part of the L.A. Wrecking Crew,
mm-hmm.
who was up there, lived up in Seattle.
Right.
He came on, and of course, Bo Diddley.
Right.
And I had a kid who I was really loved, who became a really hot producer for a while, Chris Bond.
Uh-huh.
And I brought Chris up, and we go in, and we start recording at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right, which is a great time.
I got these tracks.
Right.
I was jamming. I sometimes I just sit here at night and I just turn the sound up real high and listen to those tracks. Oh my God, Mike! Because they never were released. And Mike,
well, those are great players you're talking about too.
Oh my God, Carmine was just wackoed, and
right.
he played drums, being with those big gongs
right.
he had, and that was, I think, the highlights of my career. And those days, like going to work with Bo Diddley and working with the people like musicians like that. I never had done that before. I never worked with, you know, rock and roll kind of a group musicians.
Right.
I always worked with my guys from Philly, my band I had there, or
right.
guys up in New York.
Right.
This was being up in Seattle, and it was just fun. Oh, it was so much fun, man. I just think of, you know, the times I've had, you know, I worked with Wayne Newton.
Oh, yeah.
That was just Wayne Newton, just one of the best guys, nicest people I ever worked with. Great guy.
Yep.
Great guy. Went, you know, just those sessions are just great.
Well, he went to Vegas and stayed there, you know. So he was, you know, that was it for him.
He was such a gentleman. When you go to work there, man, he'd get you the nicest room. And then you work with him after the second show.
Right.
That's the time you could work with him. And he worked so much.
Right, of course.
Well, 74, 75, I think it was when I worked with him. And he just was working so much.
Well, didn't he do three shows a day for about 35 years?
He had a deal with the Summa Corporation.
Yeah.
He worked the Summa Hotels.
Yeah.
and which is, one was the Sands, the Desert Inn,
right,
and one other one. And I'll tell you, he just, that money was unbelievable,
right?
And he was making such mega money,
right?
So I got to really get to know him a lot, spending time in the studio with him alone, doing vocals, because we do the vocals in the Vegas studio.
Right.
Bring the tracks up and just do the vocals there.
Right.
I got really to know him very well. Really good guy.
I'm sure. And you know, well-respected. And I guess he's not singing as much anymore. But, you know, he's Wayne Newton. You know,
nope.
Come on.
He still works. I mean, he still works a lot.
Yep.
But those big notes don't come as easy anymore.
No, I know. And he says that, too. He explains that, as a matter of fact. Tell me about Chubby Checker.
Chubby Checker. The home record. Now, Chubby Checker's a good guy. I had a lot of fun with Chubby. After Chubby left Cameo,
right,
I recorded him. I did a thing called Back in the USSR with him for Buddha.
Right.
Actually did it for my company and then sold it to Buddha for release. And I have about six sides of Chubby, seven sides that had never been released.
Right.
That are mine that I cut with Chubby. Chubby's great. He's the same guy. In fact, I saw him. He was at a fair not too far from my house.
Right.
And I went to see him at this country fair, and he got up on stage, and he did the twist for about 15 minutes.
Right.
And then did my song, The Fly. There were the two songs that he did really long versions of.
Right.
And Chubby was great. I went hunting with him one time.
Uh-huh.
I used to be a hunter.
Right.
I couldn't kill a flea now.
Right.
I used to hunt when I was younger.
Right.
And I took Chubby boar hunting once.
Wow.
Wild boar hunting. And it's a true story. So we're out, and all of a sudden, bam, it's like six wild boars.
Wow.
And so, Chubby, I said, Chubby, you got to, when they start coming at you, man, you got to shoot.
Uh-huh.
The next thing I know, Chubby is climbing a tree.
That's a lot of person to be climbing a tree.
Chubby was climbing a tree.
Wow. Did he have a gun?
A lot of memories that I had from that era.
That's funny. Chubby up a tree. Well, if I run into him, I'm going to tell him, hey, what happened to that wild boar?
it's one of the few things I remember from that era with hanging out with people. because it was such a funny moment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Chubby's a good guy. Yeah, good guy. I haven't seen him except at one time at the fair. I haven't seen him in years.
Right. I'm gonna go in another direction now a little bit. You know, years ago I ran into a guy who used to come around and say, "Hey, can I book your band?" And we'd say sometimes yes or no, and he was like really banging on the door of the music business, wanted to do this and wanted to do that. And his name was Tommy Mottola. And then the next thing I know, I'm in Brooklyn with a friend of mine who I did actually sang at the Copacabana with, Frankie 13. He was a wise guy from Mulberry Street, and I did some shows with him, and he says to me, you know, we're having dinner with this guy. I said, "What's his name?" He says, "Tommy Mottola. He's got Hall & Oates." So, you know, we had a little discussion about that as well, you and I. And supposing you tell me and everybody else a little bit about Hall & Oates the way you know them.
Well, listen, Darryl John, one of the most talented people I've ever been around in my life. I had actually found Darryl first. And I recorded Darryl for Parallax Records, and I did, I think, three sides with him.
Right.
And then I had Tom Sellers, who was an arranger, who I signed as a producer and writer to our production company.
Right.
He, Tom Sellers, was friends with Darryl, and a guy by the name of Tim Moore, who has written quite a few hit songs, Second Avenue being one of them.
Right.
And an artist in his own right. And then there was the drummer, Jim Helmer. We formed it as a group called Gulliver.
Right.
And I recorded, which I think is one of the best albums I've ever done, for Elektra Records. It was for my company, but Elektra put it out.
The reason why I'm not with you, I thought you didn't want to be with me. I stayed up all last night trying to figure why you slammed the door on me. And I thought of all the things I might have done last night, some clumsy thing I didn't do or say just right. I worried myself right into a brand new day. My eyes are hot with tears and I just can't think straight. Tell me the reason why you won't explain, and I can't guess. Didn't I touch you right, or should I talk a little less? Please tell me the reason, please tell me the reason. Thinking that you may be leaving me. Oh, I spent a lonely night in the kitchen trying to fight all the tears in me. I'm still at the table as the day unfolds, with a half a cup of coffee that by now is cold. Silence that you answered, I don't understand. Though I try to read your face, you know I can. Tell me the reason why you won't explain, I just can't guess. Didn't I touch you right, or should I talk a little less? Please tell me the reason, please tell me the reason why. Tell me the reason why.
sudden, the guys really, Daryl really wanted to be a solo singer, and Tim Moore wanted to be a solo singer. And so we cut a few more sides with Gulliver, and then John Oates start hanging out at our offices, and John and Daryl just sang so incredible together.
Right.
And then they start writing songs and and I went in and I recorded about close to 40 sides with them.
Wow.
Over a period of about a year and a half.
And they were soulful guys, boy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were great. And so I had a co-publishing deal with Chapel Music, and I brought them up to Chapel and played them for Chapel, and they sang live, and Chapel really liked them a lot. And they had someone work there who was going to be bringing them around to the record companies to try to get them a record deal.
Right.
Which benefited Chapel because they had half publishing on all the songs.
Right.
And so I only went to a couple of the times they went to record companies. I was really busy in Philly doing sessions. And so I sent them up to New York, and they went out with this guy, and this guy got them a record deal. And so, and all of a sudden, they don't want to be with John Madera anymore. They wanted to be out on their own.
Right.
Which then I find out was with this guy.
Right.
With this guy's attorney, mm-hmm. who contacted my attorney.
Right.
And the guy was Tommy Mottola.
Gotcha.
Then started Champion Management Company.
Right.
And had a nice, huge management company. And then went on to do his thing at CBS.
I can feel you watching in the night. All alone with me, I were waiting for the sunlight. When I feel cold, you warm me. And when I feel I can't go on, come and hold me. It's you and me forever. Sarah,
smile.
Oh, won't you smile for me, Sarah? If you feel like leaving, you know you can go. Why don't you stay until tomorrow? If you wanna be free, you know, all you got to do is say so. And when you feel cold, I'll warm you. And when you feel you can't go on, I'll come and forever, Sarah,
smile.
Oh, won't you smile for me, Sarah? Sarah, smile. Oh, won't you smile for me?
Me feel when I keep me crazy, crazy, smile, smile.
What's funny, too, is about that time, it was probably back in the early 70s, he had a group called the Savannah Band, and he did Cherchez la Femme, and he was actually had a relationship with Corey Day, who was the lead singer, and he took her out of that band, ruined her career, wanted a relationship with her, and she said, I don't think so, you know, you're older than me, and whatever. And then he recreated that down the line with another singer that we know. But if you remember correctly, that Savannah Band, they did have a disco-type hit called Cherchez la Femme.
Yes, absolutely.
And in the first verse of the tune, the line went, Tommy Mottola lives down the road, ain't got no lady. You know, and they mentioned his name in the tune. And that band became Kid Creole and the Coconuts, which was a big Manhattan, New York hit. But pretty much, you know, he touched that band and it collapsed. So after one hit, so
the thing with Daryl and John, they were such great songwriters, and Daryl had a magical voice.
You bet,
a magical voice. And we'd come back from New York and we'd be singing the songs and you know, I'd sing maybe lead, and they'd be doing harmonies, Daryl would be singing lead, I'd be singing background rhythm. And so when that whole thing happened, it was really shocking to me.
Yeah.
I really thought, you know, these weren't just artists I'd been working with.
Right.
But they actually were part of my rhythm section. And I was using Daryl on keyboards, Tom Sellers played bass, and Jim Homer, who was the drummer for Gulliver, played drums, and Tim Moore on guitar. And I was using them as my rhythm section.
When you get that close musically, I mean, it's like family, you know?
It was. And so, but, you know, I guess people can talk people who want something very bad, they can talk them into doing almost anything.
I hear you.
Want something real bad, someone comes along and says, hey, I can get you that. What you got to do is this.
I know.
And Mike, I'm sure, man, you've been through it as much as I've been through it.
Yes. I've heard my stuff back on the radio, but I never had a top 40. But you know what? I'm just as thrilled to have been whatever part I had, a little pebble on the beach, you know, on that beach. And, you know, music was very important to me my whole life and still is, you know.
And what joy it has brought you.
Oh, absolutely, because it really... sometimes in the worst times of your life, you know, the music never turns its back on you. It's always there for you.
There you go.
In hard times.
I can go sit back here in my computer. I got all the stuff I've ever done in the computer. And I can sit back and just put on maybe the first couple years of the records we made.
Right.
And I'll tell you, I'm in bliss.
Yeah.
I'm in bliss. I close the light.
I hear you.
And just listen to that music. I'm in bliss.
It soothes your soul, you know?
It does, man. And,
so,
and I think if you can walk away from the music business, you know, after all these years, and still want to be a part of it, and still want to do it, and still write songs, and still be excited about it,
mm-hmm.
what better in life is there than that?
Every time I leave it, it pulls me back, you know. And listen, when I met Paulette, because Paulette and I have our second anniversary coming up in November, the first thing that I saw when I walked into her house for the first time, she had a 57 Seberg jukebox loaded with 200 tunes, every one of which I liked, you know. So you know, she's into the music too. And she does the show with me. As a matter of fact, the show is the Mike, you know, the Harmony, the show is the Harmony Street show with Michael and Paulette, as well as it is Mike Miller. Last week's show was filled with Paulette, as a matter of fact. So, you know, sometimes I take it on my own, and sometimes I have Paulette with me, and she has very interesting things to say about the music coming from a totally different place than I am, you know?
Well, it's interesting. That really is interesting.
Yeah, you know.
Different, whole different perspective. That's
absolutely.
Great.
So Hall & Oates, I mean, do you have any of those cuts that...
Yeah, in fact, on my website, That Philly Sound, I put out a double pocket
right.
Album with them, and it's really a great album. I had all the stuff digitally restored and remastered.
Wow.
And you hear Daryl's voice. It's so... If there was a sound... Because his voice was so pure.
Yes.
See, I think what happened was some of the songs that I did with Daryl and John, they re-recorded them at
right.
Atlantic when
right.
they went to Atlantic, their first album.
Right.
And I did versions of them also.
Uh-huh.
The versions that I did, Daryl, their versions are more produced.
Uh-huh.
My versions were simpler.
Gotcha.
And had a Daryl's voice just shined.
Well, he had a special on HBO over the last 2 years where he's just sitting back on a stool and he's got a little tiny rhythm section behind him and he's pretty much almost acoustical and he sings very laid back and, you know, you could tell he wasn't reaching for the notes. He wasn't even standing up half the time. And he was singing kind of in and around his vocal, you know, instead of
hitting the high notes.
Actually, he was kind of singing around them, but it was still Daryl Hall.
Yeah, I saw him. He was on. I'm trying to think. One of the shows just recently. One of them. I can't remember which one it was.
Right.
But I saw him on one of the shows live. Maybe it was the Letterman or one
right.
of the late night shows, and. Yeah, he was reaching for the notes. He was singing around them.
Right.
He'd catch maybe a little bit of the note and then kind of twirl it and.
Right, right. A lot of guys doing that now.
Well, you know, it's
Dion doesn't do it. Neither did Maestro, and neither does Anthony. And you know, there are still guys going up there that are so amazing. You know, that they just blow you away. I'll tell you a guy who I'm friends with and everything else that could have been Johnny Mathis if he had been handled right was Lenny Welch.
Hi, this is Lenny Welch, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Some of Lenny Welch's standard stuff just blow you away. Nobody's ever heard it. I mean, you know, I mean, he's had it on albums, you know, but people listen to, you know, Since I Fell for You, and they say, okay, I've heard Lenny. Some of Lenny's stuff is just like so fantastic that it's amazing. But he was handled wrong.
And how's his voice now?
Great.
Still can sing it, right?
Oh yeah, he's great. He works a lot. I'm trying to bring him to Florida for a couple of shows. Believe it
great.
Or not.
Great singer. How old of a man is he now?
He's in his 70s.
Oh, bless him, man. Bless
yeah.
him. He's what great singer. One of my favorites.
He just, I'll say this on the radio because it's on Facebook. He wrote me an email before he put it on Facebook. He walked into his brother's house yesterday morning and found his brother had died.
Oh.
And that was, you know, he hadn't heard from him a couple of days. He went over there, he pushed the door open, and he found that his brother had passed away. So, I mean, you know, I know how that is because it's happened, you know. I lost my brother, my mother, my father, you know. But, you know, Lenny is such a sweetheart. The guy is just, and he lives in, near Newport Beach, California, out around that area.
Well, one of my favorite singers of all time, his records have made great records and great records. I don't know if those records were cut on the East Coast or the West Coast. I always thought they were cut on the West Coast.
Right.
I don't know. I've seen him on some of the oldie shows that have on the educational channel.
Uh-huh.
And man, he's still got the chops. When I saw him singing, he was still hitting his notes and still was Lenny Welch.
I did my show 3 weeks ago was a tribute to Eddie Fisher, and it was 2 hours, and I didn't run out of tunes, and I played them back to back to back to back to back. Did you know that Eddie Fisher had 38 top 10 hits?
I
38 top 40 hits and something like 17 or 18 top 10 hits.
I know. What happened was when he died, it was one of my favorite singers. That was really another transitional singer who was like the pop, the teenage idol at the time.
His chops were fantastic.
Fantastic. So when he passed away, I went on to a YouTube to see if there was any performances in
his
latter days.
Right.
And I found one, but on there was one, if you want to see something that will just bring the biggest smile to your face.
Right.
Went on there with Eddie Fisher, Andy Williams,
right,
and Bobby Darin.
Wow.
Doing Do Re Mi. It is fantastic.
I haven't seen that one. But, you know, I mean, when Eddie came on and I was a kid and, you know, he'd come on, he'd sing, you know, May I Sing to You and Oh My Papa. I mean, I was a kid and it used to send tingles, you know. I just was very enamored by him.
Well, I went on YouTube and I took every one of his songs I'm singing and put them into my little file. You know, you can download all those YouTube files, and I just put them, the ones I love, and just put them in my little file so I can look at them when I don't want to see them.
So
they're great. They're great. I love Darlene Love.
Oh, Darlene Love. Darlene Love from the Blossoms. I was on the radio with her a couple of years ago up in Poughkeepsie on Rick McCaffrey and Gary Lee Schwartz's show. And Darlene was just such a sweetheart. I took a whole bunch of pictures with her. And, you know, of course, those people that are listening that don't know who Darlene is, she played Danny Glover's wife on the Lethal Weapon series. She was the lead singer of the Blossoms, who backed up Elvis. She was also singing with the Crystals for so many years for Phil Spector. And she just about did it all. Sweetheart.
Sox and Blue Jeans.
Yep, Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans.
With her. And I went online, and if you want to really hear something unbelievable, the David Letterman show, she did one, and when she did River Deep, Mountain High.
Wow.
An incredible arrangement. He had strings and everything. It was just a fantastic arrangement.
I will find you a tune by her. I have it on my computer. I play it every once in a while. It's Darlene Love with the Blossoms. It's called Write Me a Letter. You know the tune?
No, I don't.
It's one of the best girl tunes I've ever heard.
Write me a letter.
Wow, wow.
Send me a line. Make me feel better.
Wow, wow.
Say you're still mine.
Seems like a lifetime.
Have you forgotten me?
Have you forgotten?
Oh,
definitely one of the great singers of all time.
Oh yeah, she's every much Patti LaBelle, and she's every bit Gloria Gaynor, and she's every bit Donna Summer. She just had the chops.
You know, every Christmas Eve, or the day before Christmas Eve, whatever it falls, David Letterman has her on the show.
Wow.
And she sings the Ronettes, the Christmas song.
Right.
And she does it every year. And I've seen the last 10 years of the one she's done on Letterman.
Right.
Every year, Paul Schaefer gets a little bit better at, you know, at achieving that Phil Spector sound.
Right.
Last year, just a mind blower.
Well, Paul Schaefer's a trip.
and they've got like 12 background singers.
Right.
And, you know, huge string section and French horns. And it's incredible. I mean, incredible to hear her sing that song. And she blows away anyone else who's ever attempted to sing it.
No, I hear you. I hear you loud and clear. Hey, listen, I want to talk about Michael Gore's little sister, Leslie.
Leslie
Gore.
Sweet lady.
You know, her brother Michael wrote the music to Fame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was, I'll tell you, what a sweet lady and just a gracious, kind lady.
Uh-huh.
Someone sent me two interviews that she did on radio.
Right.
And she talks about You Don't Know Me.
Right.
How much that song had meant to her career.
Right.
And she tells the story of how we actually, she got to hear the song. Up at Grossinger's, and Dave and I were playing it for her with baritone ukulele.
Wow.
She got to hear the song that way, and she talks about that story, and I find it, she says, this was a great lady. And when we wrote the song, she was just a young girl. I mean, she was a teenager.
Wow.
Yeah, they were great sessions. We played the song for it, and we went to meet with her arranger, Klaus Ogerman.
Right. I remember Klaus Ogerman.
Yeah, we dictated the arrangement. Because Dave and I always would dictate our arrangements, and so we dictate the arrangement that we wanted, and so we went up to A&R Studios because we had to drive up from Philly, and we got there about 20 minutes late after the session had started, and they were doing You Don't Own Me.
Wow.
So it's Quincy Jones is sitting there producing, and so, you know, and we knew Quincy really well.
How could that be bad?
Don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. And don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. And please, when I go out with you, don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay. I don't tell you what to say. I don't tell you what to do. So just let me be myself. That's all I ask of you.
kind of befriended us from, he was at Mercury Records on the A&R staff there, and he really befriended Dave and I, and so here we are, sitting in the back of the studio, and Quincy's up there doing his thing, and so all of a sudden the session, the cut ends, and he turns around to us, what do you think, guys?
Right.
Quince, there's a couple of things, Quincy, the piano thing in the beginning,
right.
The thing that we're doing with piano that they're not doing, and there's another modulation, and Quincy, Klaus, stop session, John and Dave are coming out, listen to what they have to say.
Right.
He was the most gracious,
very cool,
beautiful human being.
Right.
All I can tell you is my relationship with Quincy Jones.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some guys out there, you know, like Maynard, we did some tunes years ago with Maynard Ferguson's arrangers and whatever, you know, and if you try to tell them how it went, I once had a 20-minute conversation about a chord that I wanted as an F chord. He needed to make it an F major 7th, and I told him it's not going to work against the harmony. And sure enough, when we finished the record, it was right, because I was right, because it clashed. And I said, you can't play a major 7th against what we're doing harmony-wise. And he says, oh, man, it's going to work, it's going to work. And as soon as it got to that spot in the record, it went doink. So, you know, when you get them to listen to you and say, hey, you know, hey, man, I wrote it. Listen to me.
Well, we were so lucky that we did work with arrangers that, you know, the way we would do our sessions, that we would definitely go in and sit for hours with an arrangement, going over the arrangement. Because I always said that our motto was we didn't really write songs as much as we wrote records.
Uh-huh.
We would go after a certain thing. We would start out with an idea of writing a feel with a melody. And so we always would have a groove and a melody ready with a title. And that's basically how we wrote our songs. And so when we would sit with an arranger, we already knew we wanted to bring strings in here and, you know, guitar should be doing this kind of a trip. So we would sit. But when you worked with a really brilliant arranger like a Jimmy Wisner, he would dictate an arrangement. Then Jimmy would come in and he'd add, if he gave him turkey, he'd bring you in the filling and the gravy and the cranberries.
Wow.
And you would just go, woo.
Yeah, plus every woman I ever knew said exactly the same thing to me. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say.
I know, and it's become a commercial now on the NFL.
Right.
With the ladies, they're throwing their man-made T-shirts with the man size back at their husbands and boyfriends.
Right.
But now Alyssa Milano has come out with a female line of NFL clothing.
Right.
And under the whole thing, they're playing You Don't Own Me.
Which is great.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys.
Finally, NFL Women's Apparel, fit for you. Get it at select retailers and NFLShop.com. You want the NFL? Go to the NFL.
Yeah, it's a thrill. It's a thrill.
Song lives again. I mean, you know, hey. And I'm sure that Leslie's still doing it in her act.
Well, she did a new version of it. And when she talks about it, she says that she likes doing the new version, but she always gets that really big response from the audience when she does the original version.
She had a lot of great records, one after another after another.
Well, she recorded 4 of our songs in that term when she was hot.
Right.
And we only had the 1 single release.
Right.
But she did 4 of our songs that I like to listen to all the time.
She works a lot with Lou Christie now.
Yes. I heard that, so they're kind of always on the same bill together.
Yep.
And there's a kid from Philadelphia, Billy Carlucci.
Right.
Sign with Billy and the Essential.
I know them well. They're a great group.
Maybe you'll be there one day. Maybe you'll be there one day. Each time I see a crowd of people, just like a fool I stop and stare. Not the proper thing to do,
back when he was 15 years old.
Wow.
Every note. It always blows me away. Wow. You go on to YouTube and punch in Billy Carlucci.
Oh, yeah.
At Latizzi's Club.
Right.
He does a TV show there on Tuesdays, I think.
Right.
And you see him today singing some of the songs from then. Sings them in the same key. I mean, and hits those high notes. Like, Billy, God bless you, man. You must eat a lot of extra pasta.
Yeah. So, John, I'm getting that you always really wanted to be a singer.
It started out that way. And because Dave and I really got busy, and when there were so many young kids in Philly that, you know, were so talented, and we got into producing so much, Dave always said, we were in the studio more than we were home.
Right.
It was the truth. We would drive up to New York sometimes 3 times a week because we didn't want to spend the time in New York. We wanted to come home.
Right.
But we'd have to go back to Bell Sound because they had the only 12-track machine in the country.
Uh-huh.
And so they had to go back and do your overdubs and do any mixing. So we would do that. And then we recorded RecoArt in Philadelphia also. So we were recording like crazy. So I guess a part of our life disappeared, because of that.
Well, people don't understand a tune takes like one day to record it and then like 6 weeks to mix it. So
the one blessing was a lot of the stuff we did in the beginning with mono.
Right.
You know, I remember the first time I told an engineer to run, I says, can you just not record the voices and just make the band?
Right.
He says, why do you want to do that?
I want tracks, man.
But I said, we can add his voice on afterwards.
Right.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, now they got each singer on a separate mic so that they can really do that, blend that mix. Now they have pitch correction. Now they have just about anything you need.
Oh, my God. The things you can do today, the digital stuff you can do.
That's why a 15-year-old can make a record in his house that is just as sophisticated as what took, a whole room full of equipment when they did Plaid. Most people don't know that when they did Plaid Echo, they sent the sound into another room with plates hanging in the room, iron plates, and sent it back. They didn't have...
The sound in Philadelphia had this narrow hallway.
Right.
It closed off, and when you would put strings into that room, in that small, narrow hallway,
wow.
they sounded magical.
Wow.
Kind of magical.
Because 5 strings sounded like 10 strings.
Well, it was huge. But I guess the best thing about wanting to be a singer was we had the one record in 1965 with me and Dave and a disc jockey from WIBG, Ray Gilmore.
Right.
Answered to Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction.
Right.
Dawn of Correction. And that record went top 20. And we had a chance. We toured and we did shows and went out to California, did a bunch of TV shows. And that was fun. But I guess, to tell you the truth, there is a part of me that misses that part, singing.
Right.
I do still do a lot of demos and at home. Or we just finished the new songs for the At the Hop movie.
Right.
I did one of the demos, and Dave did two of the demos at his little place in Las Vegas.
Right.
So, and when I listened to the thing I did, I said, wow, I'd like to go and make some more things.
Right.
But maybe in the future, perhaps, I'd like to take some of our hits and rearrange them. And go in and record them as an artist.
Right.
I still have the same voice I have. I still hit the same notes.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, Mike, does it ever leave you? I mean, does it ever really leave you?
Well, I have good days and bad days. You know, when I get out and sing a lot, you know, if I sing every day for 3 days, 3 or 4 days in a row, then all of a sudden it comes back. But sometimes, you know, it's like I got to open it up again, you know.
But that's what I do. I get that urge, and all of a sudden, man, I'll put on some tracks that I have here. And
belt it out.
I did some stuff with Tony Danza a few years back.
Right.
The lady who I live with, who I've been with for 11 years, Christy, worked for him. And Tony wanted to do an album. And so I went over and met with him one day. And I talked him into it. I said, Tony, he wants to do like kind of a simple album with
right.
just a rhythm section.
Right.
I said, Tony, why don't you go put the whole 9 yards, man? I said, why don't you do something with brass and really be doing Las Vegas? I said, and do something that, you know, you can go out there with a big band and sound great.
Right.
So I talked him into doing this session, and I got Artie Butler, who's a great band arranger.
Right.
Artie Butler, one of the premier arrangers of all time, got Artie Butler, and we went in and we did these sessions. But I have copies of all the tracks. So every once in a while, I put one of those tracks on.
Why
and
not?
Swing, and it's a big band, it's great. And so I put one on, and I started singing the song, and it's a thrill.
Do you know that Michael Bublé probably used every one of Sinatra's Nelson Riddle tracks on his albums, and they just ran the tracks, and he sang them in the studio and put out those albums. Most of what he used were all Nelson Riddle tracks and Don Costa tracks, for sure.
The real tracks.
Yes, I know it for sure because I know the tracks, and I'd hear some of these standards, and I'm saying, wait a minute, I have that track at home. That's a Nelson Riddle track, and for sure it was.
I've never known that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure he saved a lot of money because a lot of guys use those tracks. They're almost public domain at this point. Everybody's got them.
Just go in and, they just take the middle track out, the vocal, the stereo?
No. They sell those Sinatra tracks, without the vocal now.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, sure. They're on Pocket Tunes Music Minus One and that kind of thing where you can just buy the tracks at this point.
No kidding.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I never knew that. That's an enlightenment for me. It'll be fun. Maybe I'll go get some.
Oh, yeah. There's a Sinatra. There's one Sinatra compilation which is like got 50 tunes and it's got every tune on it. The only Sinatra tune that it doesn't have is You Will Be My Music, which you don't hear that often, but it was a great Sinatra tune.
Well, I did. I'll be seeing you with Tony in his album.
Isn't that a great tune?
Yeah, we did a really neat version of it. Very, very different.
Uh-huh.
A different version of it.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well. And I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. Summer's day, in everything that's light and gay, I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.
Tony was fun to work with. He was really a lot of fun.
He's got this series out now. He went and did some teaching, and most of the kids didn't know who he was, and he got really into the kids. It's on, I think, HBO.
Yeah, I've been watching it. It's called Teach.
Right.
He did that in Philadelphia.
Good for him.
Yeah, he did that in Philadelphia. And you know something? It's like Christy said, you know, Tony always reinvents himself.
Unbelievable.
And, the one thing that I always thought about Tony was I thought he really should have pursued the Las Vegas, because Tony was something that was missing from Las Vegas. First of all, he's funny in person.
Right.
He dances. He plays piano.
And he's real.
He plays trumpet. And he sings great. I love the way Tony sings. I mean,
right.
He's not Frank Sinatra, but he sings real good. And I said, Tony, man, what a career. I think, but I don't know why. He just stayed away from the Vegas. He did a few Vegas things, but stayed away.
Who knows? Maybe he's not crazy about the big limelight. Maybe he just wants to do it his way. And
probably. And this show Teach is really good.
Uh huh.
And it's very.
Yeah,
raw.
I've seen it.
Really shows the kids and him interacting on a real basis.
It's heartfelt, and it makes him it shows a lot of personhood, if you know that word. You know.
Oh yeah.
Personhood.
Hey, it's Daily Danza. I'm Tony Danza. Happy Friday after Thanksgiving. It's Friday. I didn't make it out, so I'm still here in Philly. Where's my tripod? I'm studying Julius Caesar, because that's what we're working on this week. Studying Caesar. It's pretty cool, actually. Amazing that this guy 400 years ago wrote this stuff that we still can... It's so personal. It's so unbelievable. I'm looking for this thing. Orson Welles did a modern-day version of it. I'd like to show it to the class. The ad for it was, you know, Caesar, this guy, Caesar's modern-day, standing over on a pedestal over a layer of fedoras. So, interesting picture. Anyway, that's what I'm doing. I'm also working on a song for the Teach a Talent show. You had my heart, now you'll never be miles apart. Maybe in magazines, but you'll still be my star. Cause baby, in the dark, you can't see shiny cars. And when you need me there, with you I'll always share. Because when the sun shines, we'll shine together. Knowing I'll be here forever. Say that I'll always be your friend. Took an old top, sticking out to the end. Now that it's raining more than ever, and that means to have each other. You can stand under my umbrella. You can stand under my umbrella. Ella, Ella, hey, hey, hey. Under my umbrella. Ella, Ella, hey, hey, hey. Under my umbrella. Ella, Ella, hey, hey, hey. Under my umbrella. Ella, 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 hey. You can run into my arms. It's okay, don't be alarmed, come into me. There's no distance between our love. Go and let the rain fall. I'll be all you need and more. Oh, because when the sun shines, we'll shine together. Knowing I'll be here forever. And I'd always be your friend. You know, take it out to the end. Now that it's raining more than ever. Know that we still have each other. To be continued, Daily Danza.
We got Tony and I got pretty close.
Great.
Yeah, you know, hanging out together when we did vocals. That's the time you get the closest with an artist, when you do vocals.
Oh, of course. Like, listen, I try to explain sometimes to people around me that when you hit harmony, I had my group Harmony Street, and I sent you a couple of cuts from them. You'll hear them. But I had three ladies and two guys in that group, and we were like a family. I mean, we sang a lot. We rehearsed a lot. We went to the White House for Bill and Hillary. We were the entertainment, believe it or not, for the White House Christmas party in 98 for Bill and Hillary. And, you know, we went in there and did an hour and a half of doo-wop and hung with them afterwards and before. and were invited back a few times, and it was a trip, you know. And but these three girls, you know, they were like family.
Well, you get very close. You really do. You get very close when you work on that, especially when you do an album. I mean, Tony's album took like 6 months to do.
Well,
and you know, you get very close.
For sure, it's an emotional experience when you're creating.
Oh my God! Especially when you're trying to save dollars. And so, you know, you go in and you're going to do synthesized strings as opposed to real strings.
Oh, yes.
You want to get that exact sound that you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
And you sit there and but I'll tell you, God bless the fact that I still love doing it.
Oh, yeah. And you know, it's great that you do it. Expressway to Your Heart, The Soul Survivors.
Yep, at Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. That was when Leon was signed to my company, and I co-published that with Kenny Gamble's company.
Wow.
And these guys are nice guys, but the Soul Survivors, really nice guys.
Where did you get the horns at the beginning of that, you know, the automobile horns at the beginning of that record?
Right.
Was that, where did they get that from? Sound effects, or did they hang the mic out the window?
No, I think there was sound effects.
It's funny.
The Joe Tarsia, the engineer at Sigma, did that session. But that was that very great Gamble and Huff rhythm section. You know, they had that really tight rhythm section they had. And I don't know if the guys played on that, or Soul Survivors themselves played on that, or they used their musicians.
I've been trying to get to you for a long time. Just constantly. I can take, but it seems like I made a mistake. But I was wrong. Ooh, took too long. I got caught in the rush hour. The fella started to shower you with love and affection. Now you won't look in my direction. On the expressway to your heart. That expressway, not the best way. It's much too crowded. No, it's much too crowded. So crowded. It's much too crowded. Love. I got caught in the rush hour. This fella started to shower you with love and affection. Come on, look in my direction. Don't you press me to your heart. That is my way. Not the best way. I fall apart. Much too crowded. Much too crowded.
You know, what's really funny is that, you know, you listen to a lot of records, you don't know what's going on. I had a talk with somebody not long ago. We were talking about records that get left the way they are. Like, if you listen closely, you can hear a telephone ringing in the back of the record, or a door slamming, or the dog rolling over, or you know, I remember the Fleetwoods, they did Come Softly to Me. And they didn't have the money to really produce it, so they found this guitar player. They originally recorded it a cappella, and then they got this guitar player and whatever, and they couldn't figure out how to keep the beat, so he took out his car keys and then he was shaking them in the microphone, and that was the ch 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 in the back. All kinds of silly things that people do in the studio in order to make it work, because there are no rules.
No.
You know.
Because you would stumble across ideas.
Right.
Things. And when you stumbled across ideas, I mean, that was wonderful. You know, what was that? Oh, it's a great sound, man. Keep that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but that's why it's so much fun. It's like a creative laboratory, Disneyland, and all of that stuff. My wife, believe it or not, was Miss Maryland, and then she went to the Miss USA, and then from there she was the runner-up in the Miss World. And she found herself going on tour with Bob Hope. And I have some great pictures of that, but she always talks about going on tour with Joey Heatherton, and I know that you ran into Joey a few times as well.
Well, Joey and I worked with Joey in, I guess it was late 65. I did three sides with her.
Right.
And then I got to, she came to Philly one day, and she was went to the actually Schubert Theater.
Right.
Used to show on shows before Broadway.
Right.
And then one of her friends was in the show. And she called from New York and said she was going to be there. And so I went down, met her, and you know, have a cup of coffee with the person I was working with.
Right.
But then we start seeing each other. And okay. We dated for about 2 years.
Okay, that's a long time.
Now she was, and what can you say? She was a tremendous, tremendous friend.
She was Joey. I mean, Dick. I went to school with Dick Heatherton, her brother, and of course, you know, Ray Heatherton was the Merry Mailman, their father, you know. And
every Friday, Mike, Friday, it was in 1966, Joe used to make fun of my car because I had a Tornado.
Wow.
And I had a 66 Tornado, and she said it looked like something from outer space.
Uh-huh.
So I would, every Friday, after Dave and I would be, you know, finish what we were doing,
uh-huh,
jump into that car, and I'd drive out to Rockville Center.
I know it well.
and that's where I would see Joey. We'd spend the weekend, and you know, it was great. And then she was shooting I Spy,
uh-huh,
in Italy,
right?
And Dickie was there. Dick Heatherton was there,
right?
And I get a call one morning about 3 o'clock in the morning, and she says, "You should come over." I says, "We're having a great time."
Mm-hmm.
So I jump on a plane the next day, and I go to Italy, and there's Dickie and Joey at the airport.
Wow.
Me up. And, those experiences. You know, what can you say about those experiences?
Well, Dick and I started
that trip that I took, a lot of movies I took on that trip.
Wow.
And tons of pictures. And I, you know, I look back at it in great times. And I haven't seen her since 1982. I think it was the last time I saw her.
Well, I don't know. Has anybody seen her? I don't know. What is she doing now?
We'll
have to Google her.
I always spoke to Dick, and he hadn't seen her for quite a long time either.
Dick and I started CW Post together in 1965.
Wow.
He was in my orientation class, and then he was a DJ on CBS FM for a while, and he was one of the first guys to have a female companion on the radio. He was working with a girl at that time, and he was spinning oldies for Joe McCoy on CBS FM way back as an oldies DJ.
Well, I've got a great picture of him and Joey.
Right.
There was a Rolls Royce outside the hotel where we were staying.
Uh-huh.
And Joey and Dickie standing in front of the Rolls Royce with this, like, exquisite pose on their, uh-huh, faces. Like, uh-huh. But the Rolls Royce wasn't theirs, but it's a great picture.
Uh-huh.
Great picture. And there's a great picture of them on the Spanish Steps I have with the two of them.
Uh-huh.
Great memories.
Yeah, because...
Great lady. I saw her in 82... She at the Trader Vic's,
uh-huh,
New York City. We were sitting there, and Bob Hope stopped at the table.
Wow!
I had met Bob in Wayne Newton's dressing room,
right?
And so we sat there, and we had a really nice conversation. And he really loved Joey. And last time I saw her was 1981, wow, 82, about then. Yeah, then she was married. Well, she had already been divorced from Lance Renssel.
Right.
Yeah, I remember
that.
Coming down to Philly. She came down to Philly for some reason,
right,
and she called me, and we had lunch at the Harvey House,
uh-huh,
at Broad and Locust. and she was really upset about that whole situation.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that was a real life situation. But
oh yeah,
that was
when they're married at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York.
Yeah, I mean, that could have been reality TV right there.
Yep, she came down, and boy, she was really upset. And and then, like I said, I saw her a couple of times. Then I saw, you know, maybe, yeah, because I saw her in New York, and then I saw her once here in California. We had lunch together here in California. But I, you know, I every once in a while, you know, I look back at those pictures. They were wonderful times. And
oh, absolutely.
Love to see her again, you know, before I go to see Elvis and Buddy Holly.
Elvis to rock and roll heaven.
Rock, you know, I'd love to see her again.
You know, but so, you know, hey, people are not hard to find these days, man. You Google a little, you go on Zaba search, you look on Facebook. It's not even so much finding the person on Facebook, but you find somebody who's a mutual friend and whatever. And all of a sudden, I mean, people are not that far away anymore. It's amazing.
I don't think even Dick had a way to get in touch with her.
Yeah.
When I spoke to Dick the last time. And there was a whole big thing that happened when she was on the road. The conductor, her band conductor.
Right.
And that turned into, like, I guess where she did, her whole career just turned around.
Yeah, who knows.
And it was sad because she, I mean, really could sing.
She was a great dancer, too.
Pardon?
She was a great dancer.
Oh, my God. She was a great all-around talent.
Yep.
And just beautiful. And without makeup on, oh, my God.
Yep.
One of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
And you know, she was 22 when we met. Mm-hmm. And I remember we used to go to church every Sunday.
Right.
The church was, that was a definite. We had, and she made sure, church every Sunday.
Right.
So she just a simple, innocent girl when I met her.
Right.
It was like meeting your first little girlfriend, you know?
And, yeah.
And we had some really nice fun, a lot of nice times.
Oh, that's a great, great story.
You know something, Mike, I swear to God, there's a lot of stories in the music business. I cherish them. I really do. I cherish them. They just weren't things that I went through. They were things that I cherish.
Oh, they're like your arms and your legs and your toes and your fingers and your, because, you know, I'm the same way, you know, with that. I just, you know, I can close the door and just, you know, turn on the computer now, I have all these tunes. I can sit and listen to myself for an hour and a half. Now, most people would say, how can you do that? You know, what an egotistical thing. But I don't listen to it in that way. I listen to it because it makes me remember.
Sure.
Who was there when we recorded it and what was going on. And, oh, I remember writing that. And, oh, gee, you know, what was I feeling at that time? And you know what I mean? I'm listening to it in a totally different way each time, a different way.
And it, to me, it's rewarding. It's so rewarding. I mean, the things I do here in the computer, musically, a friend of mine calls me up. He says, John, I need 15 seconds for a KCET thing I did.
Uh-huh.
I said, what do you need? He says, well, I need something with a beat, but I need a big orchestra.
Uh-huh.
So I just go into my little computer.
Right.
And I pull up strings, French horns, and a beat that I like. The bam, boom, boom, bop, boop, boom. You can put 15 seconds together.
Right.
And the joy that I get out of doing that is, it's like you're in the studio back in the 60s and you're doing your thing.
Because you're creating, I know.
And I think creative people, they only know what that feels like. They're the only people that really get that feeling of when you are creative and you get what's in your brain out and you can listen to it.
Hey, listen, I do guitar MIDI. I have an Ovation Custom Legend that has a MIDI pickup on it. And I can do strings, horns, and even piano with the guitar. And most people say, get out of here. That wasn't a guitar on some of the things that I've done. And they say, yeah. The only thing is, when you're playing guitar, you got to think like a horn player. And when you're playing the string lines, you got to think like a string player, you know, while you're strumming. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the things you can do today are amazing. And Ovation was always one of my favorite acoustic guitars.
Yeah, I have it. The only thing is with the round back, you know, a lot of guys can't play it. They got to get used to it. But I have one that was great. They have my picture there hanging at Ovation because they were in Connecticut, and I was in Danbury, and I lived not too far away, and I was there a lot.
That guitar always recorded so well.
Yes.
It was one of my favorite recordings.
Larry Coryell always always used Ovation in the studio, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah, they got a great sound, great sound.
Now I use, I have a 50th anniversary Strat, which records beautifully.
Oh, my God.
It's really nice.
Another great guitar.
Yeah.
I play keyboards more than anything. And,
right.
I guess that when I think of some of the guitars that I've had.
I'm looking at my Yamaha Motif right now, and my keyboard, and you know, it's sitting in front of me, but I'm not a great keyboard player. You know, I'm a three-finger keyboard player.
Not a great keyboard player either, but I, you know, it's just for writing, you know. And,
right.
So I have this one setup. It's the M Audio setup, and I have the M Audio keyboard, and I patch that into one of my programs, which has a zillion sounds.
Right.
And I've even bought some drum loops and stuff from Europe.
Right.
Great drum loops, really great stuff. And so I use my M Audio keyboard for most of my stuff.
Right.
Because I could trigger through all the different sounds I have in my computer.
Absolutely.
But you know, the things you can do today are amazing. Amazing.
Oh, yeah. You know, I just need to find the time, lock myself up here and do it, because I can't lock myself up here for hours and hours anymore, because, you know, there's other stuff to do, you know. Paulette says to me, come on, we got to go live the rest of our lives, and, you know, come on, okay, you've been up there long enough, because I can just get lost up here.
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, I missed the kind of interaction that we had in the big city in Philadelphia. Up where I live, it's there's a studio, actually, in town here.
Right.
A tiny studio, but they have great, it's all digital, and they have a really nice studio.
Right.
And I've actually never even used it for recording. I've used it for just doing some editing and some EQ work.
Right.
But nice little studio. But I have my little room here, and that's it. But I do miss the action of being in the studio, walking in with a full orchestra.
Right. No,
and,
I hear you. And
the last sessions I did, like, ever the Wayne Newton sessions. You walk into a session, and there you got, you know, 40 men. Well, actually, in the Tony Danza session, the first session did with Tony. This is funny, man. The first session did with Tony, we did a remake of the Sinatra song, The House I Live In.
Okay.
Okay, so I heard it big. You know, I heard it with the brass, and I heard it with...
You heard a big house.
Well, a big house. So we had, I said, Artie Butler, a great arranger, and we had... a lot of strings, French horns, right. And Tony walks into the session, and he wants to do it at the Capitol. He said, I got to be at the Capitol. I'm going to spend money. He says, I want to be where Sinatra works. So we had the same room Sinatra worked in, and we had the booth set up the same way Sinatra had it set up. So Tony walks in, he sees all those musicians. I think he plots. I think he does plots. He just said, What is this? I don't think he ever saw that many musicians at one time.
Wow.
You know, it for himself.
Scared him.
Artist. But once they start running the song down, and he got into it and made a nice record. It was a really nice record.
Cool.
It got a Billboard pick, and people were shocked to say it was Tony Danza.
Right.
They couldn't believe it was him singing.
Oh, yeah.
He sounded so good.
Cool.
Tony really, you know, he has something special that I'd sure love to see him pursue it in the future.
Right.
He has something real special there. And I hope his show is a giant for him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I want to talk a little bit about one of my favorite tunes, and it's called Play Those Oldies, Mr. DJ. I've sung it. I've recorded it. I listened to it. And just by a great, great group, Anthony and the Sophomores. Tell me about that tune.
When those oldies play, we listen. Makes us start a reminiscing. Oh, just thought of reminiscing.
La 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 ba, 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 ba.
One of our early few records that we made, that was back in the Jamie Guyden days when we were doing Billy and the Essentials and the Hearts and a couple of other groups that we were working with in that period. And so along came this kid, comes in and he sings a song that was kind of a little bit like Played as Always, Mr. DJ.
Right.
But it really needed work, a lot
right.
of work. So remember, and I remember him hitting these notes, and I said, "Mike, listen to this guy's voice."
Right.
I mean, who is this guy?
Because nobody that covers that tune sings it in that key. You know that.
Well, I said, "Who is this guy?" And so anyway, we sat down, and it was, I think, me, Dave, and there was a guy by the name of Bob Finiz, who actually brought the artist in to us. And we sat down, and we wrote the song, and put all those things in there, you know, all those little pieces.
Right.
Of little of other songs,
right?
And put the At the Hop ending on there.
Wow!
And so yeah, we did one other session with them. We did one other two sides with them for Mercury, and that was it was a gospel kind of a thing. I'm trying to remember what the title was, mm-hmm. but that also was a real good record. But it was more kind of commercial than the kind of doo-woppy sound that played right. those oldies Mr. DJ had. This was more of a polished record that we made, the second record we made with them. The two sides that we did with Anthony and Southwinds was Swinging at the Chariot and Better Late Than Never.
Uh-huh.
There was a place in New York called the Chariot Club.
Right.
And it was big with gospel music and a special kind of beat that was going on at the time. And, so we did this thing, Swinging at the Chariot. It was a fun record. It sounded commercial when we did it, and it never made it. But what happened was, I think we made the mistake that a lot of guys made back then. We put our records out with major labels.
Right.
And the major labels really didn't know what to do with those records. The Cameo and the Parkway Records and the Swan Records, who were local record companies, had that input to Dick Clark.
Right.
They knew what to do with records. But the majors, the Mercurys and the Columbias, and they had hits, but they couldn't handle the volume of music and really get it out there and played and distributed. They just couldn't. If they got one hit out of 30, that was good for them. They just didn't have it. I remember with 1-2-3. 1-2-3 was a giant hit in Philadelphia. Giant. And a big hit in the Baltimore.
Right.
But New York wasn't even playing the record.
No, I hear you. Well, you know, I heard it in New York, but you're right. Records become territorial. And of course, you know, one thing that we did not mention is that we had At the Hop, but we also had Rock and Roll Is Here to Stay. And, that wasn't such a bad follow-up.
that way, though I don't know why. I don't care what people say, rock and roll is here to stay. Rock and roll will always be, I dig it to the end. It'll go down in history, just you watch my friend. Rock and roll will always be, it'll go down in history. Now if you don't like rock and roll, think what you've been missing. But if you like to bob and stroll, come around and listen. Let's all start to have a ball, everybody rock and roll. Rock, oh baby 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 rock.
Oh no, it was a great follow-up, and has become a kind of a an anthem in many places.
Absolutely. You know, there's not an oldie act in the business that don't do at least one of those tunes in their act.
Right, exactly.
And I remember the day that they did that show on Dick Clark's Bandstand. I remember seeing them on, well, they were sure on a lot, but I remember seeing them vividly. I can still picture it.
There's a thing on YouTube also you should check out with Cliff Richard. When they opened up the new Wembley Stadium, they did a big, spectacular rock and roll. There were 75,000 people there. And they did a big, spectacular rock and roll show. And if you catch the segments on there, he does this one segment, it's like the last section of it, and he does all these great oldies. But he ends the show with At the Hop and Rock and Roll's Here to Stay.
Wow.
And every time I watch that, I get the biggest thrill, because I like Cliff Richard. He's a really, really special artist. I've got two things that I just took out of my vault. Absolute smash Northern Soul hits.
Uh-huh.
These would be giant hits in England and throughout Europe.
Right.
The Two Girl Things, and I did a remix on them.
Uh-huh.
They sound killer.
Wow.
And R&B right in the pocket records that was perfect, you know, for the era that I made the records, but they're perfect for today, for the Northern Soul market.
Wow.
Do I have stuff? Oh, man. I'm going to send you this thing by the High Tones.
Great.
Called Sure as the Flowers.
Okay.
And it's an ultimate doo-wop record we made back in 1961. And it's got a bass singer on there.
See,
we
do.
at him when he's opening.
Now, was this the high tones that were from New Jersey?
They may have been from New Jersey.
Yeah, I know who they are.
We did this thing called Sure as the Flowers, and, uh-huh. and I have one copy of it. One of my friends said, John, I can get you $1,000 for that. I said, get out of here. They wouldn't sell this record for anything. It's on Segway Records. I said, are you kidding? I look at that record and it brings back a ton of memories.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you can hear John Madera's enthusiasm about the business, because the enthusiasm that he had years ago when he started doing all those great things in Philadelphia, he still has now and has always had, and he will probably continue in the music business. And, of course, we talked about the movie coming out, and you're going to watch for that one. And At the Hop is going to be a bombshell movie spectacular. I know it is. I want to come to the opening.
Absolutely, Michael.
You know, so we're going to have fun with that. And it's been my pleasure tonight talking to John.
And I want to thank you, Michael, so much for the opportunity to do your show. And it's really been a fun. I had a smile on my face the whole time we were doing it.
Absolutely. You're a great guy. And, you know, believe it or not, we could probably go on long into the night.
Just
sharing and talking about the business and on and on. And we probably will do that again, I'm sure.
You know, I believe that I found myself a nice new friend.
Oh, absolutely.
And I look forward to having many more conversations.
Absolutely.
Well, you know something, again, Michael, thank you so much, man, for the talk tonight, and I wait till we do it again. I can't wait to do it another time.
Love you, man. John Madera.
Take care, Big Mike.
You too, man.
All right, buddy. I'll speak to you tomorrow.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's my interview with John Madera. The Sounds of Philadelphia. Thank you so much, John. Good night from Harmony Street. This is Mike Miller. If you want to reach me, it's harmonystreet@yahoo.com or visit my website at www.harmonystreet.biz. Bye now.
Open up your heart, recall how it used to be, remember all the love we found, ooh,
on Harmony Street, ooh, there was a place
we
that we used to go,
ooh,
when we were feeling down,
and
we were low. Harmony Street.